Welcome to the International Conference of Secular AA Authors Roundtable. My name is Megan and I have earned my seat. Today we have with us six authors from across the secular spectrum. I'm going to let them introduce themselves because they are way better at it than I am. Maria, you want to start?
Sure. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here. My name is Maria Hornbacher. I am an author. For the purposes of this conference, my name is Maria H., and I'm an alcoholic. I have also earned my seat. Happy to be in it. I'm the author of two books through Hazelden and a number of books through regular publishers. My books through Hazelden are Waiting, A Nonbeliever's Higher Power, and Sane. I don't remember what the subtitle of that one is, but that's what we're doing here today. Those are my books for today's purposes. I will bounce this to Beth.
Thanks, Maria. Yeah, I'm Beth, and I'm an alcoholic also. And my book is called We're Not All Egomaniacs, Adapting the 12 Steps for Alcoholics with Low Self-Esteem. And it's my only book. I put everything I had to say all in one book. And I'll pass to the next author.
And my name is Glenn, and I'm the author of the book I'm going to talk to tonight is called Modern 12-Step Recovery. I also have another book that's popular and used in some of the treatment centers and family groups called Stop, Things You Must Know Before Trying to Help Someone with Addiction. I will be talking to the first book this evening. And with that, Jeff, why don't you jump in?
I'm Jeff. I am, I've earned my seat as well, and I am the author of Staying Sober Without God, and also note the not-so-subtle plug here that the workbook is coming in 2023. So for the purposes of this, I will be discussing my book, Staying Sober Without God.
I was going to plug it at the end anyway, so you're just a step ahead of me.
Oh, thanks.
Vince Hawkins. The first book I did was An Atheist's Unofficial Guide to AA for Newcomers. It's kind of a rewrite of the steps so that people can go through the steps with it. Got a daily reader, Everyone's an Addict. And I put the humorous title on the email version, As Vince Sees It, because all my friends kept saying, that book, it's As Vince Sees It, isn't it? So I thought, well, perhaps they're right. And finally, this year, I wrote Secular AA. The subtitle is Advanced Design and Build Your Own Program, which tells you all you need to know, really. Thanks.
You next.
My name is Bill W. It's Bill Wolf. I teach cell and molecular biology, so I'm a biologist by trade. My first 2 years in recovery were in NA, and the subsequent 16 years AA, and I self-published a little book called 12 Secular Steps, an Addiction Recovery Guide. And that's about it.
Bill, I'll have you know your book was my introduction to secular recovery just before the pandemic hit and I learned that I could get to secular meetings. So no favoritism, I promise. All right.
Glenn.
You're unmuted, honey.
Glenn, I think, has to.
Glenn,
yes.
Pardon me?
You want to introduce yourself?
I have.
Sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. My screen's jumping everywhere. I apologize. All right. So we will have a link in the chat for you at some point with to all of these books. I would strongly recommend if you haven't checked them out, check them out. You got nothing to lose. So we're going to start. We will have a Q&A at the end, by the way. If you have questions for the authors, please send them to Marcia. This is both because of bombers and because we don't have a lot of time, so we don't want redundant questions. So let's start off with, why did you write your book? What was the intention behind it? What part of the program were you trying to reach or not reach?
I can lead off with that if you like. Again, it's Glenn, and the book is Modern 12-Step Recovery. My intention of writing the book, what I wanted to accomplish was to open the door to 12-step recovery, and more importantly, the mutual support network and sponsorship that's available within an AA, but for the secular audience. There's always been an objection to the language and objection to some of the content from the 1930s, but that's increased over the last 20 years due to trends in both religion and the fact that now AA has a lot of competition, both from the delivery mechanism being the internet, and also from the fact that there's a lot of competing programs. I'm not going to call them programs. There's a lot of competing recovery things, some of them programs and some not. What I hoped in the book to accomplish was giving the audience a view into AA recovery that had objections to the content and were part of the modern audience. How was I going to accomplish that? First of all, an introduction to recovery. Second, a modern set of 12 steps that look, act, and smell like the original 12 steps. I painstakingly worked with some people to edit them, to take out the spiritual content and put them in modern language. The second way I hope to accomplish that was to provide them the psychology behind the steps. Although Bill and Bob didn't have formal training in psychology or psychiatry, the steps have an incredible cognitive behavioral element to them in terms of what you have to do, and they're very action oriented. The third thing, and the important thing in the book, is giving a person starting out a program of recovery so they can work each of the steps. And there's only two pages on each one of those to make it very concise and clear, and give them a way of working with a sponsor quickly and something that's well-defined. And at the heart of that is a modern four-step. And the four-step draws on some modern psychology in terms of character traits and also what's called cognitive distortions and thinking distortions. And at a very few pages, it gives a person an introduction to that four-step. So that's what I hope to accomplish with the book and the tools in the book that I hope to accomplish it with.
Love it. Who wants to go next? Bill?
I see. With 12 secular steps, I wanted to combine the biology of addiction with a secularized kind of 12-step approach. And I ended up also adding a third element. The first chapter goes into a separation of recovery and religion. Because, and I have, for early recovery, the first 90 days, a problem with the traditional steps 2 and 3. And I thought that the traditional AA has two goals in that first phase, which is steps 1 through 3. You know, that I have a problem and then find the solution in God or an interventional higher power that's kind of on the supernatural side. And I thought, well, you have two goals. You know, and that is freedom from active addiction and save my soul, or, you know, a kind of covert Christian salvation. And so especially with modifying steps 2 and 3, we pare it down to one goal. And I think people, it's fine. I'm not against, you know, a faith-based foundation to begin step work. But for a secular person, I think they're going to have a different kind of faith. And that is a faith in the rationality of the program they're about to take. And then they jump to the third step and take action. And it's that taking action that's so important. And so that's what I thought knowing the biology would, because I think secularized 12-step is a better fit for the physical pathology and working with the physical pathology of addiction. and addressing, you know, things that the founders didn't really take into consideration. And so that kind of tied it all three, all three together. Looking back, I would not do it that way. I've come to believe that the biology of addiction, I would have liked to have done that completely separately. And I think I read, when I read Staying Sober Without God, I was like, holy cow, this is great. You know, and to address, I'm not a therapist, and I learned a lot reading that book about exactly what a practical secularized program can address on its own. And that's where I'm at. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to work really hard to keep my comments to myself, because otherwise we'll be here all day. Beth.
My book is a bit different from the others because I didn't set out to like replace the big book or the 12 and 12. And I didn't change the steps. I didn't rewrite the steps either. What I did is write a book with a different target audience. Phil W. describes himself as this egomaniac personality type, grandiose, defiant. In fact, Dr. Tybout, who was his therapist, even described all the early alcoholics that he worked with as grandiose and defiant. I grew up, I mean, I guess I have complex PTSD from my childhood. I never spent a single day of my childhood thinking I'm being abused. I was, you know, it was just, this is life how we know it. But I felt like I was defective since the age of five. And I learned that, you know, to hold myself back and to be always scanning my environment out of fear that somebody is going to call me out, make me look stupid. You know, like they're just waiting for you to screw up. And that's because that's kind of what my home life was like. It's, so anyhow, I had a really hard time in AA, because not just because of the God stuff, but because they were telling me I'm selfish and self-centered in the extreme, when, I mean, that was so not allowed in my house, you know, and, or they're telling me that I'm controlling, I like to be the director, and I, you know, and all this time, I'm, you know, I don't think any of this really describes me, but, and not only that, but it's re-triggering my trauma, because it's all the stuff that I got said to when I, that was told to me when I was a kid, because it was my parents who hadn't dealt with their own crap. They were never wrong about anything. It was always our fault. So I came into AA with a very weak sense of self, a deer in the headlights, got re-traumatized, misdiagnosed. And sometimes, I mean, I left many a meeting feeling worse than when I got there. So what I did was write a book for people whose personality is more like mine. We are shame-based. We don't step on people's toes. We apologize for being in their way when they step on our toe. You know, we and it took me a long time to figure this stuff out and to become comfortable in my own skin. And once I did, I just said, you know, I don't think I'm the only person, and I'm gonna just say it out loud in case anybody else relates. And it turned out that a lot of people did. So I sort of reframe the 12 steps so that people with low self-esteem can grow to feel better rather than worse about themselves with all the shaming, defects, and all of that language, and include exercises to build and strengthen our sense of self, and to grow from a place of feeling unlovable into a strong, sober person, no longer dependent on alcohol or external validation to feel good. I did not have a God-sized hole inside of me. I had a Beth-sized hole inside of me, because I sacrificed myself, my true self, to do whatever I needed to do to feel safe. And that true self was completely crushed. And now she won't shut up, so I'll pass.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next? We got three.
I can go.
Sweet.
So a lot of the same sort of background and motivations as some of the other people who've spoken. I've always been sort of at the very least an agnostic. And when I first tried to get sober, I was desperate. And so I wanted to try it the way, you know, everyone was saying I needed to try it. And, you know, so I did, I gave it a good college try. I really tried to, pray, design my own higher power, which never really made sense to me, but I tried to do it anyway. Eventually I found things that kind of worked for me in ways to approach a higher power that made more sense to me. And there were some people in the program that worked with me on that, and it felt good. But it still felt like there was always this sort of, someone earlier said it really well, this sort of like covert Christianity or a covert Judeo-Christian type approach. You know, it's not obvious. It's very subtle and sort of insidious, but you know, I would design my own or come up with my own idea of a higher power. And then people would say, that's okay. And yeah, you can make your higher power whatever you want. And then they would, you know, drop little things like, you know, as long as it's loving. And it's like, whoa, wait, hold on. That doesn't fit with my higher power. And so it was just, I was actually thinking to myself earlier, I'm like, did I write this book out of resentment? and it wasn't so much resentment as it was continuous frustration. Resentment is when something happens and I keep thinking about it. Continuous frustration is when something keeps happening that frustrates me. And I would keep going to these meetings and getting these little nudges towards a sort of Judeo-Christian approach to recovery. And so I would eventually ended up going out for a bit. And then I got back into program, but then got into therapy as well. And so I kind of got this exposure to both psychology therapy approach to recovery and the 12-step approach. And I found that there were a lot of parallels. And then I became a therapist myself and found even more parallels. And it just made more sense to me. It just started to click sort of what I thought was happening, at least in myself, when I experienced what other people would refer to as spiritual experiences. And so this book was something I had thought about for a long time, just sort of my interpretation of the program, you know, because I found myself having to go to meetings and translate in my head constantly, like, oh, when they're saying this, what they really mean is this, or, you know, when they're saying God never gives us more than we can handle, you know, what does that mean? What is it? There's obviously a kernel of truth in there. There's something of value in what they're saying, but I need to go digging for it. And I wanted to get the kernels that made sense to me and just put those out in a way that was just common sense, not common sense, but just practical. And so I start my book by just talking about, why it didn't make sense to me to take a faith-based approach. Then I have my practical 12 steps, which is my interpretation of the 12 steps, which I do not claim to be the one correct interpretation of the 12 steps. I love that there are so many interpretations of the 12 steps, because that to me is anti-dogma, which is kind of my biggest thing. It's not just one cookie cutter. This is how things are. This is what works. I'm a fan of whatever works. And if we need, you know, 150 different 12 step lists for everyone to feel like they have one, then that's, you know, what we need. So I wanted to create another one that resonated with some people, and it has, and I'm grateful for that. And then in the end of my book, I add a little bit about certain things that I think the steps miss, the 12-step programs miss, or at least don't emphasize enough when it comes to recovery. And it's some of the more boring stuff like self-care and sleep and general wellness and, you know, all that stuff that, you know, it's hard to admit how much of an impact it has on us and our psyche and our sobriety, but it does. So yeah. And my hope was just that it would provide an approach to recovery for people that felt like they were not, that they didn't fit in with the traditional approach, people that felt alienated from the traditional approach. So that's that.
Thanks, Darlene.
It's been, sorry, shall I go next?
Yes, please.
I wrote this when I was 13 years sober. This the first book I did. It was just from my own experiences. I was a journalist about half my working life, and I always had the idea that I was Mr. Average, the man on the Clapham omnibus, and I kind of carried that over into AA, although it I don't think. Perhaps thinking about it more deeply, that I was Mr. Average, but I let everybody know that I wasn't religious as soon as I came in. I suppose I did get the feeling that I wanted to. I thought I could widen the gateway, get more the people who came into a meeting and then disappeared because they saw God on the wall, and they might have gone off to die, I don't know, but a lot of people did disappear from the first meeting, never saw them again, and they complained about too much God, and I did think that if it was possible to widen the gateway in some way to write a book for these people, maybe more of them would stick around. My personality, I think, also is I think it is common to most people in AA. I don't like being told what to do, and I didn't like sponsors who said my sponsor told me to do it this way, so that's the only way I know. So you're going to have to do it this way, and attitude has always been that a sponsor should be helping people to construct their program for themselves. And so that sort of came out in it as well. When I wrote the Daily Reader, I just wanted to make a book that people could use for topic meetings. And it includes all sorts of things, including stuff from the conventions, like I attended the Stoics meeting in one of the conventions, and so I did a page on that. The thing that I think is most relevant right now is secular AA. It's again from my own experiences. I founded a meeting here in Spain, an English-speaking meeting called a secular AA meeting, and we took a whole individual approach. The people can make up their own program, hopefully, and we address the even the thing that you might not even have any steps, no steps, but the first one is probably inevitable for abstinence. And some one of the early members in that meeting was a psychologist, and he came up with a lot of his own ideas. His name was Kai. I called them Kai's bullets. So the first chapter is a history from Santa Monica onwards of secular AA. The second chapter is about meetings. How, for example, a lot of people bash God, bash AA, and it's not that helpful. And how do you get over that? And the third chapter is no steps, and then it goes on to towards thereafter to say, yeah, but if you do want some steps, here's what you can do about it. That's it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Arlen. Batter up.
Cool, thanks. I guess I'm better. Hey, everybody, I'm Maria. So the reason I wrote two books. The one that's interesting, I don't really like saying the first one. I think it's useful, but it's super, super kind of, it's fundamentally a practice saying. Waiting, I wrote because you know, there's a lot in the big book. There's a lot in the literature that borrows, you know, cheats, borrows and steals from other philosophical and wisdom traditions, religions and wisdom traditions. My goal was not to, as Beth said, my goal was not to rewrite anything, but really to speak to what I know, which is actually philosophy and my own life. You know, I don't know how other people work the steps. I don't know what works for other people. I do know that my experience of working the steps and of staying in recovery and trying to work a recovery program in the rooms to an extent wound up being so interesting to me that I'm like, you know I'm not the only person having this experience, which, you know, good God, I hope I'm not the only person having a human experience. And the reason that I wrote Waiting was really to talk about not I did this, it can work for you. I don't know if it can freaking work for you, maybe not, but I did have an interesting time working the steps from what fundamentally is a humanist perspective. It's fundamentally a perspective that arises from a variety of philosophical traditions. I was having a hard time finding a meeting where I could talk about my interest in philosophy without being told you're overthinking. And I'm like, look, dude, if you can't keep up, get out. You know what I mean? So like my tiredness of being told how I could think about spirituality really actually, as Jeff said, maybe it was out of resentment, but actually what it was I was so fascinated by what felt like the interstices between wisdom traditions, spiritual practices, the ability to stay sober, the quest to stay sober, and the quest ultimately to become a more ethical person. That is what drove me to write Waiting. I wanted to write about the process, not of getting and staying sober, but the practice of becoming within a recovery community, a person I wanted to be. You know what I mean? Learning from the people within the rooms, learning from the people outside the rooms. There's a lot of stories in Waiting that aren't about meetings or even substances or even addiction, but they were about the arc of change that I felt myself undergoing and that I observed other people undergoing that was and remains really deeply inspiring to me. I mean, the only line that matters in Waiting is, you know, to me, this is not a question of what we believe. It's a question of how we live. And that is what AA taught me. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't learn that in college. I did learn, you know, that it isn't really fundamentally important what you believe, what I believe. What matters is, can we find a common ground in how we live and how we decide to live into the world? And so that's why I wrote that book, as I'll get.
Thanks, darling. All right, you win. We're gonna open it up to a roundtable talk now. Thought it would be cool if we could hear from you guys. What you wish you had put in the book, or what after the fact you're like, man, I wish I had put that in there, or what have you learned since then that, you know, the book's been out 10 years, but it would have been really cool if we could have had that in there, because there's always that thought. If anybody has questions, feel free to chat them to the co-host. I'm going to mute now, and I'm going to leave it to the authors.
Hi, my name's Glenn again. I'm the author of Modern 12-Step Recovery. And looking at the book and standing back from it, I'm real happy with the content. I've got great feedback from, you know, they're using the book in some of the meetings out there, which I'm real pleased with. And there's individuals using it for sponsorship and things of that nature. The one thing I wish I'd included in the book is a chapter for the other 12-step recovery programs, both Al-Anon, you know, gambling, sex, and the other people, to give them a vision on how they can use a 12-step program of modern content, meaning with some psychology behind it and a little different version of the steps. I know that there are some groups using this other than AA groups. Some groups are using the book, but I wish it had a chapter in there for this purpose. Other than that, I'm pretty happy with it. And one of the reasons I think that it's being used out there in some of the groups and with some of the individuals is that I've provided some of the book's content for free. That is, there's a website for the book, and you can print the steps out, you can print the modern 4-step process out, and that's opened it up to the groups and individuals to use. And that's what I have for you on that.
I'm grateful that I went the self-publishing route, because I feel like these are things that I can add kind of, you know, pretty easily in my second edition, which is basically just whenever I want to release it. You know, some of the feedback that I've gotten I want to have more content in my book that is, sorry, I'm going to mute someone. So powerful. I want to have more content in my book sort of geared towards, I guess, minority populations, you know, women in recovery, just people who have had just different identities, different people who've had different experiences. But kind of by definition, I don't think I can write that myself because I haven't had those experiences. But, you know, just addressing the vast array of different experiences that different people from different backgrounds can have and unique challenges that they may have, you know, that others may not, or, you know, a straight mediocre white guy like myself may not have. So things like that, just adding more inclusivity stuff in there. And then also, you know, I'm very like kind of a very logical step-by-step thinker. And so I wanted to write kind of like an instruction manual and maybe sprinkle in like some humor in there sort of. And I know a lot of people really respond well to stories. That was never something like, I just want to know, like, what do I do? And I don't get super into stories, and that's just sort of my weird, like, left brain dominant sort of way of thinking. But I think adding some stories into my book is something I would like, because I do think there are a lot of people who, you know, want validation that there are other people that are not super thrilled, other people besides just me that are not super thrilled with the religious and faith-based approach to 12 steps and want to hear stories about people who've navigated their way through that. So that's what I think would be nice to have in there.
So one of the things that stuck out to me as you guys were all giving us a history of your book is that they all seem to be on the same principle as where new meetings start from. Like, you have a resentment, and so you leave the meeting and you find another person who, if they don't agree with you, your resentment, if nothing else, they're going to support you in it. And you get a cup of coffee and you have a new meeting. And I feel like that's kind of where these books come from, is resentments towards the literature or towards the I guess, the themes or flavors of the different meetings and the literature being read and what's being pushed at you. So you decided, I'm just going to write a new book. Does that sound about right? I don't like your big book. I'm going to write my own.
I'll actually pipe up on that, Megan. You know, I'll tell you, most books come from the awareness someone has that this book doesn't exist, so I'm going to write it. You know, so, I mean, does it all come from a resentment? Maybe so, maybe not. I've probably written books out of a resentment, books that were out of something else entirely. A wild hair got, you know, I mean, like, I had an idea, then I realized the book didn't exist. You know, so for me, my book in this particular case came from simply the fact that there isn't a full body of literature from the secular perspective here, from whether it's humanist, whether it is a developmental, whether it's self-help, you know, however you genre it, there's not yet a body of literature. It's becoming a body of literature, but I just kind of wanted to throw something in the bucket. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted there to be something when somebody goes to the bookstore and is like, help, I'm a drunk, I need to read something that doesn't tell me how to be religious. I want there to be a couple shelves. You know what I mean? I, you know, so a lot of what I was doing was just trying to add to the conversation there. And I think, you know, if it came from a resentment, all right, but, you know, still put a book on the shelf. I'll take it, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah. And I don't know if I would say that it's from a resentment, but it's definitely fighting back against dogma in my own way, like fighting back against this message that this is the one and only way. And if you don't do it this way, you're not going to make it, sort of thing. And so, you know, just making more stuff available so that the people who are saying this is the only way get drowned out a little bit, maybe, you know, or don't have as much power. Because, you know, if they're the only game in town, they can kind of say that. If there's a ton of other paths, good ones, hopefully, but if there's a bunch of other resources, then they have less power over people, and people are going to feel more free to find something that works for themselves. So mine, more than trying to rewrite the program or anything, was to try and create one that works in parallel with the one that already exists, but is a path that didn't yet exist. So sort of broadening the highway rather than trying to replace it, if that makes sense.
I would have to say that mine didn't grow out of resentments per se. I wrote the book after working in treatment centers on a volunteer basis and working with groups and seeing that a lot of the audience was on an increasing basis turning off to the information. So my book isn't a replacement for AA, but a clarification of it for the modern audience. And but not out of resentments. Did I resent it when I came into the program and I was in treatment and I saw the 12 steps for the first time? I almost ran for the hills, but I had good counseling. I had good counseling from somebody.
If I can jump on the question of what I would do differently, just kind of route it back to that, because I know a couple of us have not quite exactly spoken to that. One of the things that I would do differently in my book is, you know, I did not self-publish that book. And so it's through a traditional publisher. And like as I have experienced with all of my books, publishers gravely underestimate the intelligence of readers. And so I feel like I was asked to take things out that I think you as readers would have enjoyed thinking through whether you agreed with them or not. You know, I feel like traditional publishing dumbs down materials badly. And so if you're thinking about publishing a book, bear that in mind. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you are thinking about it, like if you want to keep the cool, dense, footnotey stuff, you know, think about self-publishing. I think there's a lot to be said for that. I going back to waiting, I probably would have brought in a lot more of the conversations that I have with you guys, you know, because they are dense, they are interesting, they aren't easy, they aren't comfortable, but they are really enriching. I would have brought a lot of that into the book rather than excising it the way I was asked to do.
I think one thing I might do differently, I talk a lot about childhood trauma. And for many people, they think, oh, that's blame your parents. My parents were fine. And so like they don't even look any deeper. And it's not about blame your parents. It's at all. Our parents were human beings. They had their issues just like we do. They were emotionally immature just like we were. They, you know, and some of that stuff got passed on projecting is like one of the things that immature people do. You know, it's not me, it's you. Oh, don't talk about feelings. Don't even have feelings. I'm not talking about being beaten. I'm not talking about being molested. I was dropping my kid off at a daycare center one time, and the director was comforting this two-year-old whose mother was leaving. And it's very normal for a two-year-old to cry when their mother is leaving. And she was holding him and she was patting his back. And she said, "Don't cry. You've got nothing to cry about. You'll make your mother feel bad." That is bam, 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 wrong, wrong, wrong. But yet the child is being comforted and held. So it doesn't, hearing these messages about how to behave at the same time that you're being comforted, it's very confusing. And as a kid, you cannot figure that stuff out. But I think some people are so put off when I say childhood trauma and they say, oh, that doesn't apply to me, because they think it means that they were, you know, beaten or, you know, or starved or something really, well, more obvious. But emotional trauma is the hidden trauma that I would venture to say almost all of us in AA went through as a kid. I mean, I'm not going to speak for everyone, but there's something about how we felt about ourselves that made us feel better when we drank. Like if we were so comfortable already, you know, that we wouldn't have had to do that. I would open up more about, does it mean your parents were abusive? It doesn't mean they did deliberately harm you. Just because there's too many people that, oh, well, my dad fought in the war. So like, I think he had PTSD. So I can't, you know, I'm not going to blame him for anything. Well, he was actively having a psychological problem, you know, and that probably did affect you. But you don't want to look at it because, well, it's not his fault. He went to war, you know, but we're not talking about fault. We're not talking about fault. We're only talking about what people did and how it affected us.
We have a question from somebody who wants to know, in an environment where we are told that uniqueness, that we're not special, and that we need to fall in line, and that the uniqueness is going to get us killed, what made you guys decide fuck that. I don't like what you're telling me, and I don't like what's on this recovery buffet, so I'm going to go make my own. That's paraphrased badly, but.
Well, for me, the big book was written for narcissist recovery. Like, you know, so fall in line. That's what they need to be told. You're not special. You're not, you know, even the whole reason a higher power became part of the program was that they required an acknowledgement that they were not God. That wasn't ever my issue. I can see lots of powers greater than me just looking around the room, you know, and just because I don't believe in God doesn't mean I think I am God. I mean, I guess I must think I'm Santa Claus too. I don't know. But for me, that those messages are intended for narcissists that need their egos broken down, and they were not what I needed to hear at all.
I think one of the... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff. You go.
Okay. Okay. I think one of the things that was so instrumental to me in my recovery was being able to think for myself and learning how to trust my good thinking. You know, one of the things that I hated hearing over and over in the 12-step program was, you know, how my best thinking got me here. My best thinking got me here. You know, meaning like this is the best you're ever going to do. Is going to end you up in 12-step recovery. So don't ever try to think for yourself, was sort of the message that I got there. And that kind of, again, I'm also, you know, super, I have a lot of self-esteem issues. I have a hard time taking any kind of compliments. You know, like I'm the kind of person who, you know, if you step on my foot, I'm going to apologize for being in your way sort of thing. And so being told that I'm stupid and I'm never going to be able to figure stuff out myself and I have to turn everything over to this being that I can't even, that doesn't make sense to me. It was disempowering. And when I went through my own sort of path of recovery and got some good therapy and looked at my own trauma, but also just, you know, whether you want to call it trauma or not, just my past experiences growing up and how it shaped my behavior patterns, it helped so much to be able to have my own voice, know what my own boundaries and needs are, be able to speak up for them. That was all just so instrumental to me because I never had my own voice. I never had confidence in myself. And, you know, and I think the hard thing there is for me is to learn the difference between, you know, confidence and arrogance. What are things that I can feel confident in? What are, you know, what are thought patterns that I can have that are, you know, what does healthy thinking look like? And how can I tease that apart from more reactive, unhealthy, addictive type thinking? And so, but I needed to figure that out, and figuring that out was huge for me. And, you know, and that newfound sort of freedom to think for myself was not compatible with the, at least the meetings I was going to. And so I felt like I needed to make something else.
So I'd like to jump. Go ahead. Meg, go ahead.
Nope.
I'm just going to say really quickly that the sort of idea of like, none of us is unique. All of us is exactly the same. That's super, like, you know, so this is the canned story I have about this, but it is a true story. In a meeting not too long ago, I got very cross. They were reading the chapter to wives, which of course was written by Bill. So I was in there, I was feeling grumpy about this being even read in a meeting. And I was like, you know, I'm grumpy about this. This is very odd. And a nice middle-aged white man came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I was taught, young lady, basically, there is no age, race, or gender in AA. And I'm like, that is super interesting to me that a middle-aged white dude just told me there's no race, age, or gender in AA. I'm just saying, sir, that's intriguing. And so like the idea of we're all, you know, we're all narcissists, we're all arrogant, we're all selfish. For sure, we're all human beings having a consciousness, and that's fucked up right there, right? So here's the thing about we're all the same. No, we're not. We're all coming in dragging these little baggages of social crap that we're coming in with, right? I'm coming in with my social baggage. You're coming in with yours. And if we get in there and start telling each other how to feel, how to be sober, how to live, we are all screwed because none of us did it all that well the first time, right? So I'm just thinking this is like the business of I can't be unique. Let me tell you, I am a mess if I don't recognize ways in which I am maladaptively unique. So, and I don't also provide service. If I don't recognize ways in which I can speak to young people, women, people from other backgrounds. Like if we're all waiting for the middle-aged white dude with the middle class background and the middle education, right? If we wait for him to be representative to everybody, we are, as Vince said, closing the gate. We are narrowing the path. That isn't our job. Our job is to make sobriety available and attractive to kind of anybody who needs it, right? And to be advertisements. I can't advertise good sobriety to somebody who has no background, education, like nothing in common with me, but I can advertise it to somebody who's really kind of having a hard time fitting into the middle, right? And if that means I have to say, I'm not exactly like everyone here, and that makes me unique, okay, I'll act like a grandiose narcissist. That said, some other weirdos a little bit like me may be able to find their way into sobriety. And I hope that's a service I get to provide.
If I could add to that, I think the job of AA is also to help people find themselves. I don't think I knew who I was when I came into AA. I thought I knew who I was, but I didn't. I've discovered all sorts of different things. I can be a kinder person, better behaved person. I can be an artist, a writer. Well, I was always a writer, but I can be other things. I can be nice to my mother. My wife told me the other day that she wasn't afraid of me anymore. I mean, it's a bit late after 24 years of sobriety. It's something. And I do think we're all different and unique. I don't think there's anything narcissistic about that, because that's why you need a program to suit you individually. Having said that, we have the fact that we have great things in common, like we understand each other, great understanding of each other about alcoholic problems, is a wonderful feeling in a meeting. And then if you overlay that with a sort of a secular meeting where everybody's non-God-based, possibly, that's another thing that we have in common. There are groups, aren't there, for women, men, LGB, I forget the rest. so that people do have these great things in common, and they can feel understanding of each other. I think there was another point I wanted to make about resentment, which was I did feel resentment, but it wasn't to AA. I found the group AA, the AA institution, was very kind. I went along to the head office and saw the publications director, and he explained that I had permissions to reprint some of AA's stuff, blah blah blah, what I wanted to do. And he said, "We like your book, your type of book." It's great. I mean, they don't get approved at the AA convention, but I find it a great advertising thing to put on the cover, not approved by Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's some of the meetings that I would have a resentment to, but I don't have to go to those meetings. I can go to meetings that where I feel comfortable. So that kind of works. I don't think as secular people or any particular kind of people that are going to a particular kind of meeting, we want to make the mistake of telling other people what to do. I hate it when people tell me what to do. And I if there's a nice, if people feel comfortable in a Christian meeting, maybe in the southern states of the US, good luck to them. They're getting sober as well. Hopefully, if there's somebody who isn't Christian, they can find a meeting that they feel comfortable in. Thanks.
So that actually does lead us into one of the other questions, which is, do you guys attend regular meetings? Are you a regular meeting maker, or do you hide?
I still attend three in-person meetings a week. That's dialed back from my early recovery where I was doing six or eight. But my other participation in the program is through the writing, but I also work out at one of the major treatment centers here on a volunteer basis. I go in and speak to the inpatients on a schedule to be able to answer questions and give them a bridge into, you know, the recovery community. I've started to do some work with some new groups that are starting up locally and wanted a different mechanism for working a 12-step program. And that's been real enriching because actually, I mean, it's self-aggrandizing too, because I always bring my book along with me. But it's been very effective for me keeping that in front of me. I'm participating tonight as much for myself as for all of you in the audience, because it helps keep the recovery in front of me all the time. With that, I'll pass.
I'll say I have a lot of admiration for people who are still going to meetings regularly. I feel like I should be, but I treat meetings kind of like spot vacuuming. You know, I just every once in a while when I notice like I'm feeling kind of rusty, sort of
rusty.
Feeling sort of rusty in my recovery or disconnected from the just overall community. I'll go to some meetings. I'll do some stuff like that. But I use meetings more as a means to finding people to talk to outside of the meetings, because I've never particularly liked meetings, just to be honest. I wish I liked them more. And staying crusty without God. Yes. I wish I liked them a little bit more. But I find them to just be, I get too squirrely. Maybe it's my ADHD, but I have a very hard time in meetings. I love talking to people outside of meetings. I love staying connected to people. I love fellowship. That's what's so important to me, is to feel like I have a real connection. Every once in a while, I'll find like a small, more intimate meeting where it's more of a conversation, and those I like. But I've never found big formal meetings to be super helpful for me. But that's just my personal experience.
I still attend the same home group that I started in 37 years ago, when those people told me I had to get God or I was going to die. But I've outlived all of them, and I've been telling my secular story for the last 10 years. And the group is probably 50% agnostic, 50% believer now, but we all get along great. And that's the way I think AA should be. You know, we do read how it works, which if I really listen to it, it's completely invalidating me. So I just don't listen. And I don't read it when asked to read. I say, not that one. No, thank you. But we close with the we version of the Serenity Prayer instead of the Lord's Prayer. So it's still a regular meeting, but it's got quite a few non-believers, and we all get along well.
I do go to meetings. I go to mostly virtual meetings, but that is partly by virtue of the fact that I live on the road full time. So I travel full time. Somebody asked me in the chat if I'm writing about travel. That in fact is my next book. It is about being on the road full time. But the function of meetings for me is what I believe to be the function of meetings, which is that they are a support group. You know what I mean? Like, I get to go in and here we are, and this works. This works too. You know what I mean? I can go to a lot of support groups and find a little human connection and a little context for myself. You know, left to our own devices, perspective gets really wacky, right? And so I go to secular AA, I go to regular AA. I always wind up in fights in regular AA. Anyway, it's fine. I go to a lot of mindfulness-based meetings. I know John is laughing, right? Shut up, man. So John knows why I get in fights at meetings, but I also manage to get in fights at mindfulness meetings too. You know what I mean? I feel like didacticism just throws our purpose, right? Our purpose is really to provide a net for each other. At least that's how I see it. We're supposed to be a thread, you know, and if we can do that for each other, it doesn't really matter to me what the name of the meeting is, what other people in it believe. The fact that I get to be in a room and I can, you know, if I want to sit there and judge everybody, I can do that. If that's helping me stay sober, congrats, Maria. On the other hand, if I want to learn how not to judge people, I can sit in the same room and learn how not to judge people. You know, it's all going to be up to me. So
I go to at least 2 meetings a week. I did have a crisis about meetings around about 20 years. I thought, should I keep going to meetings? And I thought, well, I wouldn't be helping anybody if I stopped going to meetings, maybe. And so that's what kept me going. But since then, I've realized that I would have been in trouble if I'd stopped going to meetings, because they keep reinforcing not drinking, and I would have been stupid, because I know that if I don't go to a meeting for 3 weeks, it did happen once, I get really tetchy and start thinking about drinking and get grumpy and it's not good. So I know that meetings are keeping me on the straight and narrow. Somebody's asked me a question about meetings in the UK, and somebody called Kevin. I'll just say, Kevin, send it to my website. It's just www.vincehawkins.com, and I'll look up the answer to your question. It's about whether there are secular meetings in the UK. Yes, there are, but I need to look it up.
So, question from the audience. Why is it that all of the books seem to ignore Bill's suggestions that we deal with relationships the same as any other problem? Asking what it hurt or threatens self-esteem, blah, 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 if you know the defects. And why don't any talk about forming sane and sound ideals for those relationships? Banger of a question.
For my own clarification, is the question regarding all the books in question, are we talking about the ones by the authors currently present, or are we talking about the books about recovery more broadly speaking? Anybody else got a thought on that?
I believe so. I believe they're talking about the authors present.
Okay. I will speak to speaking only for myself. I cannot speak to other people's. My book actually definitely tackles the question of relationships in community. I am solo. I don't relate in a coupled manner. So community-based relationships are a big piece of what I'm trying to do in the world, is build community connectivity. And so does that mean I relate well one-to-one? I try, but that was not particularly the focus. I think that may be a book that remains to be written, and I'd love to see somebody write it. I think that's a super important thing. I just am not, that's not my focus at this time.
I guess you're quoting from Bill's letter in emotional sobriety. And personally, I found that letter very almost traumatizing, triggering, because he says that when we don't get what we want, we start demanding it of others. People like me don't make demands on other people. You know, we're like trying to lay low and hope you'll tolerate us and not kick us out. We don't demand. And so I have a hard time with that whole thing. But I do talk about relationships in my book. I talk about boundaries. I talk about codependency and how we have to learn, you know, where we end and somebody else begins in order to. And the one thing I would change, I didn't talk about a sex inventory in step 4, but I'm thinking it would be really good to do a relationship inventory and talk about what did I bring to the table? What did they bring to the table? How much of myself did I actually give away in order to maintain the relationship? For people like me, that would be what we do. For somebody else, it would be how much of them did I stifle because I had to have things my way, maybe, you know, but I think those would be really good things to review. And I wish, and if I did another version, I would put that in.
You're muted, Megan. No, I wasn't muted. I was channeling my Xanner to give you guys space to talk. Okay. If not, we can move on to the next one. I recently shared with a close male friend of AA that I don't relate to men's stories, and he was shocked. That really surprised me. We both have over 30 years sober, but beyond us both being alcoholic, there's very little in common with our histories. Do any of the writers think that we need to address this more aggressively?
Now might be the time to, I do have a panel or a webinar on gender and recovery on Thursday through Hazelden. If you guys want to go, I think we were going to mention at some point, this seems
we're
suitable.
Plug it at the end.
Okay, cool. Sorry. But anyway, I think it's a major, conversation that we need to be having. That said, you know, we can't really say it's an outside issue any more than we can say God is an outside issue, which is gets thrown at all of us. We've all fielded that one, right? Like that's an outside issue. I'm like, okay, well, I can get sober or I can't. That's not really an outside issue for me. I do think, you know, and I've said this in lots of ways, like racism, I think we're all carrying cultural baggage into these rooms. We're carrying who we are, right? Just as we carry the stories and the traumas and the experiences of our individual lives, we're carrying our cultural lives around us like a little snail shell, right? We drag it around with us. We bring it in. It informs what we say to each other. I do think we need to be talking about not only how gender dynamics affect our rooms. I think we need to be talking about how race affects our rooms. I think there are major cultural problems that need to be taken up within the rooms, and they are not outside issues. That's my take only, though.
Yeah, I agree. To just add, I think what's so important to me is that everybody is that a environment is created where everybody feels comfortable to share that, because I feel like there are a lot of people who don't feel comfortable enough to share their unique experience when it comes to gender and race and things like that, and to be heard and to have that acknowledged. And so, you know, that's my hope, is that we create an environment where everybody is able to share those stories and we hear more of those stories.
Glenn and Bill, you guys, Vance, you guys have been very, very quiet. I would love to hear your perspective on this question.
I can speak to it. One of the key things that participating in recovery has provided me in general is a heightened awareness of everything. I mean, I was a drug, alcohol fueled, dragster with about five missions, you know, to be right all the time, to fix things. I was the James Bond of fixing people, you know, get out there and try to fix things. I've changed a lot because of recovery, and once an improved awareness. And I think what we need to do is always carry that awareness regarding gender, race, and other dimensions with us in all of our activities in recovery, so that we can see it coming at us. You know, when the topics come up, we're able to embrace them and be careful of biases that we've carried around with us for 50 years, you know, that creep into a conversation that are not intentional, but they're so ingrained in us from being around certain things that, you know, like gender bias, there's a lot of subtle gender bias. And even in your conversations and meetings, you might fall prey to some of those things. So I'd like to think that the race, gender, and other dimensions like that I'm improving in terms of my overall awareness, and it's just another dimension of awareness that the recovery community has given me.
Sometimes I get hit with the comment that and this is from traditional AA people, and I'll kind of explain, hey, what is secular and what's different about, you know, secular 12-step or secular AA? And after explaining it a bit, more than once I've heard, you people need to make your own organization, and that kind of... I don't have the answer to that. I do think about that sometimes, and I lean towards, no, we don't. The bad thing about having a religious foundation is dogma. is, you know, a religious foundation tends to want to keep the literature, the traditions, the methodology. They want to calcify it. This is the truth with a capital T and not change it. And I think one of the important things that secularizing AA will do is increase diversity, increase the stories, increase the individuality to everybody's path to recovery. And that needs to happen. Sometimes I think I'm not one for speaker meetings. I have never told my story. And I kind of dislike drunkalogues and NA war stories and things like that. And also, I kind of think that the exact content of how you do step work or how you do a program is not as important as being active in a program. And, you know, so, yeah, this is an important question. And I still kind of believe that, no, we don't need to make a whole new organization. And secularizing the organization we have will increase diversity.
Did anybody else hear him challenge me to get him onto Secular Story Time to tell his story? I'm so sure that was a direct challenge. Okay. So here's a, I really like this next question. Let me scroll up to it. So does not addiction by definition require a degree of narcissism? And if so, would that not mean that there is not one shoe that fits all, especially if some do not see themselves as being an egoist or narcissist? I'm gonna let Beth start with this one because I feel like she literally wrote the book on this.
Well, my therapist says I'm not a narcissist. So she's known me for a long time. She said, and there is such a thing as being shame-based in treatment. They told me they diagnosed me with chemical dependency, codependency, eating disorder, and a massive shame-based personality. And then they told me to go to AA and get my ego beaten down. So no, I don't think all addiction involves narcissism. And I think the worst thing that Bill put in the 12 and 12, since AA doesn't offer any alternatives to the big ego, there's only one alternative they offer. And he says, he talks about his dependencies on people, places, and things, and how he sinks into this flip side when they fail to prop up his ego. In step four in the 12 and 12, he says, we get a painful pleasure out of our self-loathing, and that this is pride in reverse. We have lost all humility. So that's what I hear people saying when they feel bad about themselves. They're told you're an egomaniac too. You're just invested in how bad you are instead of how good you are. For me, I mean, it may be that was the case for Bill. I don't know. But for me, that is complete bullshit. For one thing, you know, self-pity, why me? That implies that I think I deserve better. Like I have some sense of entitlement and I don't. I question every day whether I deserve to be alive or not. I did not get any pleasure out of my self-loathing. I was contemplating suicide all the time. It wasn't fun. And basically what this sentence did was give me a new way to question my reality, which I'm very good at doing because, you know, I must be in denial about enjoying this and I must be prideful in reverse. It was the most unhelpful thing I ever heard.
I'd like to speak to this topic a little bit. For me, the program and working in recovery has actually removed some of my narcissist tendencies. You know, the Glenn of 15 or 20 years ago was a very single purpose machine designed to get my way, be right, fix the world. I mentioned that before. And all of my behavior, a lot of it could have been interpreted as narcissistic. but it's helped to remove that, you know, my self-aggrandizing. I'm much less king baby than I used to be. And the program has helped to remove a lot of those dimensions from me. And I think somebody today looking at the, you know, the more contemporary Glenn, the Glenn in recovery, would consider me, you know, more of a people person and a team player and things of that nature, which I think are starting to get me on the other end of being a narcissist. But I still have to work on it every day, practice those new dimensions. King baby certainly creeps up every day. That's one of my default settings when I wake up in the morning. So I have to dial that back every day. Thank you.
I can speak to this a bit just from the mental health perspective. So, you know, I wouldn't say that narcissism, in my experience, the addicts that I've spoken to, the addicts that I've worked with as a therapist, in my experience, there is a commonality between all of them in that they've had some significant form of harm, possibly trauma, not always trauma, but there's definitely a history of emotional harm in some way, shape, or form. And I mean, of course, you could say who doesn't have that, but specifically a form that they've learned to soothe through the use of some sort of substance or behavior or something like that. So, you know, I think the addiction is a learned behavior based on just an underlying feeling of being unwell, being uncomfortable in your own skin, which is, you know, still, I think, a pretty good description. That harm can manifest itself in a lot of different ways for a lot of different people. So some people will take on more of a narcissistic, you know, that will sort of be their coping skill, is to be, you know, grandiose and feel like they need to be incredible and amazing just to be okay. You know, so it sort of moves in this one direction, whereas other people will become, you know, more self-conscious, and I don't deserve to take up any space. I don't deserve to have feelings or my own voice. So it manifests itself in different ways. So I would not say that I think every addict has narcissism, but every addict that I've met has some history of developmental, emotional, or psychological harm. It's just manifested itself in different ways for different people, and therefore requires a different approach when it comes to the treatment of it.
I completely agree with that. And there are, I mean, well, one book that I read, I'm not going to say any book has all the answers, but like there are different responses to trauma: fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. I was a fawner. Bill was a fighter because he had childhood trauma too. And I wish somebody else would write a book about fighting and, I mean, flight and freeze, because I couldn't speak to those. But yeah, it's just not one size fits all.
I think it's just important to remember that I believe, I'm not sure whether I'm right, that you're still an addict even when you stop drinking. I think I'm still an addict. But I've changed a hell of a lot. There might have been some narcissism when I was before I stopped drinking, but the program has certainly helped me to improve my behavior and as a person, and so that I think I'm still an addict, but I just behave better.
Can I just jump on like definitions? And I think, you know, to the question originally of, you know, doesn't addiction by definition imply a certain level of narcissism? No, the definition of addiction is an addiction to a process or a substance, and it's physiological in nature in terms of definition, Jeb. But the larger question of whether everybody who deals with it is also a narcissist, you know, I think we're throwing around a lot of mental health terms as if we're agreed upon definitions. And I don't think we are, in fact, all working from the same glossary right now. So I think, you know, the definition of narcissism is different than definition of narcissistic personality disorder is different than the definition of a narcissist. So, I mean, like, those are three distinct categories of things. And so, like, before we start mouthing off about, like, I'm not saying you're mouthing off, I'm saying I'm mouthing off. Before I start mouthing off about what's what, I will say that, like, you know, does addiction, you know, imply narcissism? No. I can definitions. I don't think it does. Not by definition. I can say that, like, my bad behavior as a drunk resembles greatly my bad behavior as a sober drunk. And it has to do with, like, do I get my shit in gear or not? And do I use the steps to make that happen? I do. I find them super helpful. I find the principles that underlie them helpful. Whether or not that speaks to me being a narcissist or not a narcissist, again, I think we got to go back to, like, you know, my maladaptive behaviors, do they all come from trauma? Probably not. It might come from the fact that I'm kind of a jerk. You know, so I don't think everything has this sort of mid-century can be traced back to the Freudian sort of everything was bad when I was a child and everything got better when I was sober. It's not that way for everybody. And it doesn't always follow that arc. You know, maybe I was a jerk when I was born and then I drank because I wanted to be a bigger jerk. I don't know, but I don't drink now. And so I get better. And so I feel like, you know, there's no one rubric that makes this make sense for all of us. And I think that's kind of what we're getting at here is that we're all so, you know, it may be narcissistic to say we're individuals, but I hate to break it to you. We are in fact individuals and we're all dealing with our stuff as best we can. I do find it useful to use these steps and the principles to do that. I don't think the definition of addiction includes, you know, a qualification of narcissism. I am less of a jerk when I'm not drinking. And that's as simple as I need it to be some days, you know?
So authors, I'm assuming that you get the same pedestals that a lot of our other authors get. And I would like to know personally how you deal with it and what, if anything, if you could ask the general population of secular AA to stop doing regarding putting you guys up on these pedestals that you're going to fall off of and hurt yourselves from. If you could ask us to stop, what would it be? How can we help protect you from being put up there?
I just don't accept the pedestal to begin with. I know who I am. I don't belong on a pedestal.
I'm very pedestal oriented. That's part of the pontificating and those kinds of things. I have to watch and not put myself on a pedestal that I can be knocked off of. In my corporate life, my corporate life put me in front of audiences, large audiences, and in those audiences, it helped to behave as if you were on a pedestal a little bit, just so you could get your message across and the intent of it. But, you know, again, those are pedestals you can get knocked off as well. So I have to manage that. I have to manage that aspect of my personality, being careful to not put myself above others in terms of either knowledge or wisdom or anything of that. And again, that gets back to being more of a team player. I try to be a member of the team rather than as the big book says in other literature, rather than being the director. And before I was exclusively the director, producer, and actor, main actor.
I don't feel on a pedestal, but I do get tremendous pleasure from signing books and having a little queue at the conventions when they're face to face. And I've written another book, a curious one about the local cemetery here in Valencia, and it's All Souls Day. And there's going to be a similar thing. I'll be signing books on Tuesday. And it just gives me a little release of endorphins. I don't feel as though I'm flying up in a rocket ship up through the clouds. It's nice though.
All right, I'm going to go directly to Bill for this one because he's been super quiet and you have to play too. So can you, usually we discuss toxic narcissism. Can you address the concept of healthy narcissism?
Yeah. Wow. I've never thought about healthy narcissism. I can't really address narcissism very well, I don't think. I can address self-centered a little better, and self-centered doesn't really equate to narcissism. I kind of feel that in the progression of addiction for me, when I went from kind of like a mid phase to to a more advanced phase, my world got smaller and smaller. And I did become more self-centered. And a lot of that was through huge problems with depression and despair. And in early recovery, I was talking with my sponsor one time. You know, he was saying, you can't always be a floor mat and things like that. And I don't know how we got on the topic. And I said, yeah, I'm really not very self-centered. And he said, oh, yeah, you are. You isolate. You spend a lot of time in depression. Yeah, you're not overrunning people, but you're not. You spend too much time thinking about yourself, and that's different. It's healthy to break out from too small of a world. And, you know, that one of the big things that, NA and AA did for me was my world did get bigger in there because there were people, I was learning to socialize again, especially in early recovery. And also I was picking up tools that I didn't learn through my childhood. And that helped tremendously. And so, yeah, there's a healthy moving away from self and a centeredness on self. But I wouldn't say a healthy narcissism, if that makes sense. And that's what I had to say about that.
Can I pop in here real quick? Somebody just sent me, I love this. The question, Megan, do you have time for me to quickly respond to this?
We've got all the time in the world. We're in a breakout room.
Yeah, good point. So somebody just pointed out that Kohut wrote about healthy narcissism. And I think this is where the sort of the question is coming from, as elements of healthy narcissism are strong self-regard, empathy for others and recognition of their needs, authentic self-concept, self-respect and self-love, courage to abide criticism from others while maintaining positive self-regard. And I think, you know, whether or not we agree to the term narcissism, healthy narcissism, the idea of right-sizedness, which is familiar to all of us from the rooms, is really helpful. I'm sure that to some people, my healthy self-regard may look grandiose. To other people, my healthy self-regard may look self-deprecating. It kind of depends on where you stand. You know what I mean? I mean, to me, right-sizedness has to do with acknowledging my strengths, my weaknesses, areas for growth, areas where I have capacity. The right-sizedness is not regarding myself as better or worse than you. It isn't actually other-oriented. It is oriented to what are my capacities? What are my strengths? Where am I still being shitty? You know what I mean? And so that isn't self-abnegation, and it also isn't grandiosity. It's recognizing that I'm evolving, and one hopes that's an ongoing process, right? So if some dude comes up to me in a meeting is like, you're really grandiose, and I'm like, dude, you just can't keep up with what I'm saying, that's his problem, right? And what other people think of me. And if somebody else is like, oh, you're too hard on yourself, I'm like, actually, no, today I'm being pretty grandiose. It doesn't matter what somebody else says or thinks about my size. I am the one who knows what I can and can't do. And again, to the question of humanism, humanism is just the sort of recognition of what reality is and an endeavor to ethically accept and respond to it as it is. In the same way, I feel like there's a way in which self-regard and right-sizedness can be an honest assessment of who I am, good and bad, and anywhere in between, and an ethical effort to improve upon that, accept it for what it is, but improve upon it. You know, I mean, that's to me healthy self-regard. And I think that may be the question that healthy narcissism, maybe a language difference.
Thank you. Okay, so unfortunately, because we do have to stop the recording, I want to get this one last question in on tape before John's computer explodes. Thank you, John, so much for your service. So we have had an influx of questions regarding why is secular AA recovery's biggest and best kept secret? And what can we do to get the word out, to spread that secular AA exists? I personally identify with this one because I didn't know it existed either until Zoom. Tomorrow we have the general members panel where they will be doing a whole lot of stuff, including electing new board members. And those are the people who are kind of heading the effort to get the word out through H&I and things like that. So what, if anything, do you guys suggest to help break this secret and make it a norm?
I'll talk to that briefly. One thing I would suggest, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous in general has one of the largest networks of meetings. In my area, there's 1,300 AA meetings a week. There was the last time I took a survey online, 1,300 AA meetings a week and a great sponsorship network. One of the things I'm advocating is just hijacking those networks, hijacking the meetings and networks. And by that, I mean, like, take a book, you know, here's self-promoting again, like take my book to a table and start working with that, or Staying Sober is being used out there, but use it within the current meeting structure. And I don't have to be listed on the AA website if they don't like what I'm doing, but start to use that network so that you can have tables of secular, specifically secular tables, and it'll start promoting itself and promulgating by using that network. Some of the new recovery programs that are out there are having trouble getting off the ground because they don't have that network already established. So I'm going to advocate hijacking the traditional AA network as one strategy. Now, with that, I pass.
Thank you so much. Real quick, because Beth has to run, she's a very popular lady. Did you want to say anything before you head out, darling?
I could talk. What I did to spread the word about secular AA was, well, first started a meeting, then we wrote a pamphlet, a little trifold called What is Secular AA? We printed up a bunch of them, took them to the intergroup and had intergroup reps take them back to their meetings to let people know about us. It had a link to our website. When they had the office managers of all AA convention here, we distributed a bunch to all of them to take back to all of their offices all over the country. I've just done a lot of things locally to get the word out.
We are not closing out. However, if you were planning on attending the We Are Not All Egomaniacs or the Lopsided Triangle AA meetings, they are starting now. Thank you so much, Marcia, for your service. And we will see you in the next workshop. I'll meet you there.
Thank you, Megan. Great job.
Okay, thanks, so everybody.
Thanks, Megan.
About,
thank you. Okay.